Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a renowned multi-award-winning composer, musician, producer, and singer-songwriter whose body of work is truly monumental. As a solo artist, he's recorded 16 albums and had numerous hit singles, including Uptown, Uptempo Woman, Concrete and Clay, and Nobody Made Me. But most of his classic songs became huge hits for some of the greatest music stars of all time. Everyone from Bing Crosby, Rosemary Clooney, and Shirley Bassey to Petula Clark, The Fifth Dimension, and Kool & the Gang have recorded his songs. Some of his biggest hits include Weekend in New England by Barry Manilow, I Can't Make Music by The Carpenters, Isn't It a Shame by Patti LaBelle, Down in the Everglades by Willie Nelson, If Love is Real by Olivia Newton-John, Blue Street by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, The Laughter and the Tears by Dionne Warwick, and of course, Sunny Days, recorded by his mega-talented wife, Jackie DeShannon. And if that weren't enough, our guest is also one of the most highly acclaimed composers for movies and television, having written over 100 soundtracks for movies, including My Cousin Vinny, The Mask, Ghostbusters 2, Twins, Kindergarten Cop, 6 Days, 7 Nights, Dragonheart, Beethoven, Anaconda, Diabolique, Gettysburg, Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, and Last of the Mohicans. Some of the TV shows and series he's scored include MacGyver, Backdraft 2 for Netflix, and Citizen X for HBO. And believe me, I'm just scratching the surface of this man's compositions. He's received some of the most prestigious awards, including an Emmy Award, 13 BMI Awards, including their highest honor, the Richard Kirk Award for Outstanding Career Achievement, the Composer and Lyricist Guild Lifetime Achievement Award, and an honorary doctorate from the University of Cincinnati. In addition, he received nominations for a Golden Globe Award and a BAFTA Award for Last of the Mohicans, and nominations for the Saturn Science Fiction Award for Dragonheart, and a Gold Spirit Best Comedy Award nomination for Leap Year. His live show entitled A Life in 80 Minutes played to sold-out audiences and got rave reviews. He's written a musical entitled Shortcut about the construction of the Panama Canal, and he has a new album coming out entitled Can't Be Killed by Any Conventional Means, and his brand new single entitled Everything is Possible, on which he collaborated with legendary rapper Grandmaster Mel, is now available for streaming. I'm delighted to welcome Randy Adelman to our show. Randy, thank you so much for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks, Harvey.
Randy, I read that you started out as a pre-med student. How long did it take you to realize that a career in music was the right thing for you?
Well, I was interested in music since I was a kid, but I come from a really proper Jewish family from New Jersey, and music, you know, you got to be a professional person, a lawyer, a doctor, blah, blah, blah. So I had that, like, you know, kind of banged on my head for years, although it wasn't that they were unsupportive. So the music was, it wasn't like I went to pre-med and suddenly decided, it was already there. And I was actually there for a different reason. But while I was there in a great city, which to me was like going to the moon, to go out when I was 16 years old to Cincinnati, was when I switched to the music conservatory, blah, 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 long story. And so it wasn't like I was there and I really thought I was going to be not a doctor, but for me, it was being a dentist, because that was easy. You know, you didn't get, but of course I couldn't stand even the thought of it. So it was never a true reality.
If you're a coffee lover like me, it's always fun to discover a great new blend. I recently found a terrific new company, Breakfast at Dominique's, that's created a series of coffee blends to honor the legacies of the greatest Hollywood legends. And I'm thrilled to tell you that now Breakfast at Dominique's has introduced the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend. It's my very own exclusive, delicious, bold, rich, balanced, medium roast coffee, and I just know you're going to love it. It's made from high-quality organic beans produced using fair trade practices. If you'd like a great cup of coffee, give Breakfast at Dominique's a try and order the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend at hollywoodblends.com. They'll ship it right to your door anywhere in the world. Sipping our coffee is the perfect way to watch our show. Who were your musical influences growing up?
I was straight classical. I mean, go through that. I was a classical pianist, you know, everybody from obviously Beethoven and Bach and then Mahler and Stravinsky, all these people. That's what I did. However, I always loved sticking my ear to the radio and listening to pop music and listening to not just the song, but what was going on in the background, the string arrangement, the rhythm section, the background singers. And that thing, which was in my brain since I was 7 or 8 years old, and listening and imagining somehow myself, I don't know why, a part of that is what was in my gut, even though I couldn't explain it to anybody. And this was like around the time of the Beatles. So when I was in school, you had to be, you know, play sports. Music was not hip. Yeah. So, but all this was in my head. So I was going home and playing serious classical stuff and really loving it. But I also had this other thing. And so early on, that was, you know, I had this, it was almost like a little secret that no one else really knew. I didn't play in the school band. I didn't play with the orchestra. It was just, but it was dead serious as far as my obviously love for this passion.
One of my dearest friends, Tony Orlando, told me that he discovered you way back when he worked for Clive Davis. Is that right?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, when I was in school now, this is it's a little tie-in, but toward the end of my time in Cincinnati at the conservatory, and of course, I mentioned my parents, of course, what's this kid going to do? And they kept saying, you got to get these education courses so you can teach music in a high school, which was about as far as their brain went as far as what this kid was going to do. And I had a cousin who worked somewhere at BMI, a performance organization, didn't even know what the letters were. And somehow, this is so interesting, my whole life would be different if it wasn't for what you just said, possibly. Really? Oh, yeah, possibly. Of course, any, you know, other things could have happened. So this cousin of mine, in kind of a conversation, he was a lawyer at BMI. Somehow he got me a meeting when I came home from school. This is late when I was a junior and my parents were getting a little like anxious, like, what the hell is this kid going to do? And he got me this meeting at April Blackwood. April Blackwood, it was the publisher for Columbia Records, okay?
Yeah.
And I walked into the first meeting. I'd never been to a meeting in my life. What was I meeting about? And I had a little tie on. I took the bus from New Jersey. And I walk in, and there was a guy named Neil Anderson. And there was another guy, the professional manager of April Blackwood, named Tony Orlando. He was very, very heavy at the time, but I knew Tony Orlando from putting my ear when I was 8 years old to the speaker because he had had records, Halfway to Paradise, bless you, as Tony Orlando. This is way before. He wasn't Dawn at this time. He had a job, and I had these tapes, and I didn't have anything else, and I put the tapes on, and I guess, you know, they were like tracks, and there must have been something that he related to, and I'm sitting there, 18, 19 years old, with my little tie on and an attaché case, and I left there, and he like wrote to me or sent me a letter when I was back in Cincinnati, and I told my parents, and so when I came back, literally a month or two later, I, of course, got in touch with him, and that was the beginning of me being signed as a staff writer, but I wasn't a writer. I'd never written a song really in my life, but Tony saw something, so they stuck my name on the door, gave me $50 a week, not as I wasn't employed. It was an advance as a staff writer, and I loved Tony, and he gave me, we were just involved a short time. But that was like, when I look back, there's, you know, just like in your life, there are always keys. And boy, then something else happened and he sent me somewhere and blah, blah, blah. And the funny thing about Jackie, this is really, I'll give, This is about Jackie and tying with Tony. So I knew Tony for that time, and he was very supportive. And then, I mean, it was literally a year later, I had this little job conducting, and somebody named Jackie DeShannon walked in. She was playing at the Copa across from the Persian Room in New York. And I sang two songs when the dancers changed costumes. That's what was a time killer. But I guess she thought the songs were good. So the next day, her agent, who was the agent for the person I was conducting for, said, Jackie DeShannon came and she wants to hear some of your songs. I said, you know what? It was now the beginning of the singer-songwriters. I wanted to do an album. I had started writing a few songs. I never returned the call. Never. I called Tony. I was seeing Tony intermittently. I call him and I mention, he said, what's going on? I said, I'm recording my album. He said, what album? I said, I made a deal. Like I signed my name on a 100-page contract because I wanted to do this album. There's something else going on. Your word, girlfriend, dump me. And there were all these sad songs and I wanted to get back at her. So I wanted to record these songs. Anyway, so he calls me and I mentioned, I said, I heard from Jackie DeShannon came in the other night and I got a call, but I'm not, you know, I want to do my own thing now. And Tony Orlando goes, what? He says, do you know who she is? I said, well, yes, she sang this. I really didn't know about Jackie, her writing, her opening for the Beatles, all this great stuff. Not What the World Needs Now is Love, or put a lot of other very cool stuff.
Yeah.
And he says, meet me at Colony Records at the corner of Broadway and 52nd Street. I said, why? He said, where are you? I said, I don't know, I'm about 20 minutes. I meet him there. We go to the old record bins. We go to under D. We go to Jackie's name. And he pulls out her album. And he said, listen, not only is she brilliantly talented songwriter, take a look at her.
Yeah.
Now, okay? It wasn't meant like that, but it was like, hey, the worst can happen. She'll record some of your songs. Anyway, that night I went home. I brought my laundry home to New Jersey in a pillowcase. And my father used to get really mad. Like, what are you going to do? You're bringing your mother to your laundry. And right at that moment, my father was a CPA. He's looking at the television. And who comes on a variety show but Jackie? And I go, oh, that girl, that's the one who called me. And he says, did you finish that album? I said, I'm just finishing. He said, well, what are you going to do after that? I said, I don't know. He said, you're calling her tomorrow. So I had Tony and my father. I called back and the rest is, you know, history on that end. So that's a little something just about Tony. So he made a difference in a couple of things in my life.
Oh, big time. Well, I want you to know, he was so thrilled when I told him you were coming on the show. He loves you. He sends you his love. And he's immensely proud that he did see and hear something in you.
No question.
That's a gift he had to find something in you that you may not even have known you had yourself. But yeah. I want to ask you, you know, I mentioned in my introduction, so many mega stars have recorded your music. Can you describe what does it feel like to hear one of your songs performed by a legendary artist?
Well, you know, that was like I said, you know, because I've been doing something else for a long time. That was early on. I never really planned to write songs. If I was going to be in the commercial world, I figured I was going to be an arranger, a conductor, a producer of records. But as far as myself, I had never really thought of myself as an artist or songwriter. And this was just before that explosion, you know, not back with Dylan and the Beatles, but a little later with, you know, Elton John and James Taylor and Carole King and those kinds of people. So I suddenly started writing these songs. So when you say, how was it? It wasn't immediate. So I would do these albums. That's how people heard my songs. It wasn't like I wrote a song for Barry or I wrote a song for Dion or the Carpenters. No, I just did these albums, which frankly didn't sell. But obviously the songs were good enough so people got into them. And then when I, it depends on, I'd have to go, which I won't hear, into specific cases, because in my history back then, the songs that they recorded, whether it was Barry doing Weekend New England or Patti LaBelle with Isn't a Shame or the Carpenters with I Can't Make Music, they weren't necessarily songs that you would hear and say, that's a hit. They kind of picked, including, by the way, Bing Crosby, the last song he recorded before he dropped dead on the golf course in Spain, the day after he recorded my song, and I was supposed to meet him the following Sunday to listen to it, and it was written about my grandparents. It was like, why would he record this song? If you ever listen to it, you will hear why. But anyway, the point I'm making, you asked me, so depending on who it is and what was the song, that my reaction was always Harvey, 100% fantastic. I really appreciated anybody. That's the first answer to your question. As far as if it blew me away, or that would depend on the way they did the song. The way Karen Carpenter sang an odd song called I Can't Make Music, and Richard arranged it. They asked me to go on tour with them, which I did, playing piano in front of like 15,000 people a night when I'd never played the piano or sung in front of my mother. Nobody. That was it. Boom. Here you go. You're an artist. And that was with them. But to answer your question, I'll make a long story short, obviously, I always, first of all, appreciated it and loved that they would hear anything of mine and think well enough to actually spend the time to record it, obviously, in their own way, which is their, you know, their prerogative to do something like that. But it was great. But it wasn't like an immediate thing. I did several albums and boom, 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 here, there, and built kind of a really odd career doing that, along with getting my feet wet in other things that would really point the way, unbeknownst to me, to my real future.
Well, you mentioned Karen Carpenter and the song I Can't Make Music. She also recorded you and Piano Picker.
No, Piano Picker was Richard. That was my key with him. That's a silly song I wrote on my first album about learning how to play the piano and definitely at the last second saying, I'm not going to put this on there because I want the song to be all these sad songs so that my girlfriend who dumped me can hear it. Piano Picker doesn't figure in there. Luckily, it's on there. That's what turned Richard on to me and in turn them. But a Piano Picker, so that's, if you listen, it's like the only song Richard ever sang, you know, is Piano Picker. And
I loved it.
You can make your judgments on that. He was a brilliantly talented guy. That was not his highest moment.
Well, I loved that song. I loved I Can't Make Music and You. I think Karen Carpenter had one of the most perfect female pop voices in history. And I love that she recorded your songs. I want to ask you about your song, Isn't It a Shame, that Patti LaBelle recorded. Am I correct that you had no idea that Nelly turned that song into My Place until it became a huge hit?
Not a clue. You'll say, how is that possible? Well, now cut to a million years later, when I'm the busiest film composer in the world, I never listened to the radio, I never got Billboard. And all of that certain summer, while this thing is going up the charts, and someone called me, and I thought it was someone, by the way, who stole my wallet. That's who I thought it was. It was an attorney for Nelly calling me from St. Louis to see who owned the publishing. Now, it turns out that 6 months before that, the record company, whoever it was, had properly done everything by the board and gotten the rights to the song, of which I got half, you know, the songwriting credit. So that's all, you know, you say, that's all I care about. So it was all done above the board. It's not like he stole a song. It was all, and then I found out when I checked, yeah, they did it. You'd think that's how this business is. Wouldn't you think that someone who was as hot at the time as Nelly did one of my songs that somebody would call me and say, by the way, Randy, no. And guess who publishes that song? You know the answer. April Blackwood from way the hell back. Tony Orlando.
Now, your parents would that's what you call Bashert. That's what your parents would say.
But yes, you got it. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm fascinated by the fact that in the early 80s, you make this career switch. You begin writing scores for movies and television. Given your background as a classical musician and conductor, there you were writing 3-minute pop songs. Even though they became big hits, I would imagine it's not as musically challenging and fulfilling as writing scores for movies and TV shows. Am I right?
You're more than right. You're exactly right. You hit it on the head. However, understand it's obviously you're sitting here and it's a bit of a generalization. I may have been writing songs that people were doing, but I wasn't exactly the guy in that. And as far as the TV and film scoring stuff, even though I had started on that early, I had done little TV movies, Bup, this and there, the Chipmunk animation there first. I wasn't doing a lot of stuff. All that stuff, as you know, in your own thing, Harvey, it takes something. You got to hit people over the head 50 times for something to happen. And with me, so I wasn't really doing that in the 80s. I was doing a little bit of everything, but I decided no more songwriting. I had done a bunch of albums. And I'm going to be the guy I thought I was going to be years before, the more arranging, conducting guy, which you may say, Jesus, that doesn't sound exciting. But I tried to focus on that. But it's impossible to break into that. I don't care how brilliant you are. You can't get in, you know. It takes something. Danny Elfman had Tim Burton, a director, who liked Oingo Boingo. That's how he didn't have the norm. Hans Zimmer had a different thing of a picture he did that Barry Levinson's wife heard, and that got him Rain Man. I mean, I'm just giving these examples. Everybody needs something. They all have different backgrounds. Those guys don't have traditional music backgrounds, but they're wonderful. So my thing was, I had really, was really at the end of my, my life was good, but I was obviously needing something to happen. And what happened is a little movie happened. And you know what? I wish I could show you a picture behind me, because the picture behind me is of one of my dear friends who just passed away from Hamilton, Ontario.
Canada.
Yes. Danny Goldberg, who had a friend named Ivan Reitman. Danny had directed one little movie. And again, it was almost like completely different. It was like a Tony Orlando thing in a way, because you would say, well, Randy, you'd been around, you'd done this, you'd hit songs. But as far as a film composer, he could have hired 20 other people, but he hired me. And that was the connection. At the same time, his friend was making a picture, a huge picture in town, about something that could have been a terrible concept. It was about a big guy who was a big star named Arnold Schwarzenegger and a little guy who was a big star named Danny DeVito. And it was called Twins.
Yeah.
And they hired the great French composer Georges Delerue to write the score. But Ivan, who's a very, he's also, they're both gone this year. Unbelievable. He thought he may need something else. And Danny said, hey, you got to meet this guy who just did our little film. And I came in and did a couple of cues. And that was my big break, though I didn't know it at all. And one thing led to another. And I wrote so much and they used so much that they had to give me co-credit. And, a month later, Ivan calls me and said, we've waited 5 years. We're making Ghostbusters 2 and you're doing it. And scared, that was the biggest comedy of all time up to then. So that's when I got the start, even though I had done themes and pictures before, nothing that anybody would take any notice of. And that led to, Twins and Kindergarten Cop and all that stuff, which led me, strangely enough, to allow other people because all that stuff was comedies. And I didn't think that I was funny. I really wasn't writing funny music. And that those credits allowed somebody else to twist somebody else's arm. The best director in the world, for my money at the time, was an English director named Alan Parker. Another one, every single person I just named this year is not on the planet anymore. But Alan Parker was making a film, and it was great, called Come See the Paradise, about the internment camps in California in the 40s, in you know. And that was, long story, great. And that's what Fox took to Michael Mann doing Last of the Mohegans in a terrible situation. The film was too long. They didn't think anybody would want to see it. It was historical. The person starring in it, a greatest actor, but he'd never been any film that was commercial. He had done a great film, My Left Foot, Daniel Day-Lewis. So it was a disaster. And they brought me in again, in a way, the way that Ivan had brought me into Twins. And that worked out completely. And the same thing happened even more so with Last of the Mohegans. And then after that, and then Ted Turner called me for Gettysburg. Then I was a film composer, you know, after all that and all the stuff I had done. But that's, you know.
Well, you know, when I think of film scores and how powerful they are in evoking the emotional reactions of the viewer. Like, for example, the first time I saw To Kill a Mockingbird and listening to Elmer Bernstein's score. You know, when you first decided to write film scores, did you have favorite movie soundtracks that inspired you?
I did, like you just named one, you know, and I loved Elmer. Elmer Bernstein sent me to Ireland to do the Mask. You'll say, what does that have to do? Long story, but he had worked there. They had no money. And I had talked to him and he said, go there. They're giving you 10 cents. You can do whatever you want with the 10 cents. And I said, yeah, that sounds good. And then we had laughed about that over the years. I knew scores, Harvey, but the way I guess you would know them or you would like them, I know a million people, of course, film scoring now is a whole different animal and became, you know, got kind of a high, you know, priority and over the years ago, but it was different. I wasn't one of these film score nerds. So I just knew, like you mentioned, I knew Dr. Zhivago by Maurice Jarre. I knew Henry Mancini, you know, but I wasn't into that as an aficionado of film scoring. But I, of course, loved it. And it turns out that all my background in everything by that time turned out to be the perfect background for dealing with scoring under pressure, scoring fast, writing all different kinds of genres, knowing how to, if it was an Eddie Murphy film or My Cousin Vinny, going to the studio and making something that sounded like a record, but was a record in terms of what they wanted. And then going to the next cue, which may have been the most sentimental or romantic or passionate thing imaginable. So all the background that I had done converged via this one little thing happening to put me in a position. And then I was locked in a room for 25 years. I never came out. Never. Never wrote one song. Never. And people would ask once in a while. Yeah, because I didn't want any of these people. I also now I'm an old fart, but I looked much younger than I actually was at the time. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I was like a new guy in town, even though you would say, well, but nobody, you know, if, like I said, if someone isn't hitting you over the head, you know, number one record, the Oscar, blah, 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 they may not exactly know what's going on. So it looked like I was the new kid in town. And I was able to take all this musical versatility through just hard work also. It's not just your talent. And put that together and able to get into this new field and really burn. And as you said from the beginning, yes, musically just phenomenal for me. Because you write a cue and you make something work And even though you go through a lot of political stuff, depending on what the film is with the studio, it gives you a great deal of satisfaction. I'm sitting here in my little house that I have behind my big house, and I just sit here. And if I'm left alone, I mean, I'm like right there every night. And I imagine I'll write a cue, the most insignificant thing, the film I'm doing now, putting in a little Christmas carol while the main theme of the film is going on of mine and making it fit. And I'm like, oh my God, this is fantastic. Is anybody going to notice it? If I don't point it out, probably not.
But I don't know. What?
I do. And that is, at this point, all I care about.
Do you have to be a great musician in order to be a great composer for films?
Okay. Well, okay. There, you got two questions here. It always helps the better musician you are, but you can also be a brilliant musician, as most of these performers are, and never be able to write a note. Now, okay, that's a general thing about composition. All great musicians aren't great composers. And the other flip side of that is what you just asked. All composers aren't great musicians. Now, being able to write for film is not only just a craft, and you have to have all your, you know, ducks in a row as far as orchestration and being able to look at something and get a feeling about what music may support that specific cue, that instance that you're going to try to convince the director may need music. You don't have to be, let's put it this way, I'll say this honestly, you don't have to be a musician like me to be a great film composer. I love to play. I may not be the greatest film composer, but I'm good at that. Now that, which used to be a piano and a moviola, has changed. You've got all this technology. So you've got to learn that and get into that, because that's part of the whole thing. But the answer to your question is, it's always better if you are adept musically, but you don't have to be. John Barry was a trombone player, but he had the essence to create all that, not just the James Bond stuff, but Out of Africa and Dances with Wolves, and a million other things. But that's what he was. You have to have that something, that magical creativity inside to be able to look at something and write something that supports a scene when you don't have anything to go by. And I always say, if you're a film composer, you have to be fast and right. Both things. If you're fast and you're wrong in what you created, that doesn't work.
No.
And if you're right, but you've taken too much time, that doesn't work either. You got to be quick and on the money, as far as, because each film is different. You don't have time. I could spend a year on any film, and maybe you have 2 weeks, you know, so you have whatever the time is, and you're dealing with, you know, the directors coming over and wanting to hear stuff. Oh, yeah, you know, it's just like, and they hadn't thought of something. Well, just because they haven't thought of it doesn't mean it's not any good. But you're the new guy. You're the guy who came in. Every story, every film, it could be the silliest film in the world, has a history, could be 20 years. About Adam Sandler and Billy Madison. What's that? It's been around. And until he got to be a star and in the position to make his own movies, Gettysburg, around forever. Every actor was going to do it. Then they passed. Then this and that and the other thing. Finally came around to Ted Turner, who had a little station he had started after CNN called TNT. And he decided to make this book, but it had been around for years before it got to him. It's called Killer Angels. That's what Gettysburg was based on. So, you know, you're the last guy in, the composer. Everybody else, the producers, the writers, the director, may have been involved forever. So it's a challenge that fortunately I kind of took to.
Boy, did you ever. You mentioned Ivan Reitman. You've worked with a lot of directors, Ronald F. Maxwell, Rob Cohen, Alan Parker, Michael Mann, so many of them. From the perspective of a composer writing a film score, what are the qualities that constitute a great director for you?
Well, yeah, that for me, it's basically one word, openness. Because a director that comes to you with preconceived ideas, by the way, they do a full temp score. That's the music that they have with their movie. That's the music that they use to preview. And you'll go, geez, so the whole movie is scored before I get it, in most cases. Now, what does that mean? You have to write the score. That means that I have to write a complete original score, but guess what's in their head? This music that the editor has put in that they're living with. Now, try to get one of these guys off. Obviously, they're not going to use that exact music, but the mood and the tempo and the passion, the darkness, the color of a certain cue that they're using. Now you come in after they've been on this for 80 years or, whatever, a month, I mean, a year. And you say, you know what? I'm going to play you something to that same scene. It's a little different. So, what I just said to you, I want someone who's going to be open to standing right here next to me and listening to something without their mind cluttered with either a preconception that they may have thought of or the exact music that they had in that spot, because I'm telling them for certain reasons, I can do something that's like the mood of what you had, but I have something I think that's going to heighten the drama, maybe it's comedy, of this scene a little more. So what I found, Harvey, is I worked with, it's incredible, lots of first-time directors. Now, a first-time director who may have had, I always say, how is this guy directing this big picture, $100 million picture for a studio, blah, blah, blah. And then there's always a story. And they are obviously more nervous when they come over here because guess what? They're thinking about their next gig already. And so, whereas it sounds odd, but the tougher guys like Michael Mann, like Ivan, like Alan Parker, they are tough. That's who I like working with
Really?
because they accept, they will listen to something. They're smart, they're experienced, and they're not nervous. They may say they hate something, that's fine. And then you come to the creme de la creme, who you may say, based on his unbelievable background, is going to be the meanest mother in the world. Ron Howard.
Oh.
Absolute best. What a doll. Guess what? He didn't want to hear anything. He did what you do after I flew to Greenwich, Connecticut, where he lived at the time, and maybe he probably still does. If he hired you, he trusted you, or he would have hired someone else. That's, of course, the way you always want it. But that's not the case. You say, hey, they can hire any, especially if they have the budget, but anybody they want. They picked me. So why are they busting my,
Well, so let me ask you this, Randy. How much of your job satisfaction comes from the success of the movie versus how much you enjoyed the experience of working with the director?
None. Everything is what you just said. And in my show that I now it's become my a whole thing, me doing my little life story, though it wasn't supposed to be. I say just what you said. It's not the success of the film. That's always great if that happens. It's the music, and because I talk about some of these people, I really. When I do what I call my, I do a ha-ha medley, which is a million of my hit comedies, not a million, enough in a certain that people are sitting there having drinks and will listen to. And then I do my non-ha-ha medley. And the way I start the non-ha-ha medley is with Gettysburg. And I say the very thing that I mentioned that about the directors. But I say, in that case, you take away the music. The movie is, of course, a part of that. But the relationship you had. And in that case, my relationship was with a guy named Ted Turner, who was just, you know, forget it, just a wonderful human being. And we hit it off. Does he know about composers or music? No. All he knows is that when they tempt Gettysburg, and every time one of those Confederate officers died on the battlefield, there was this piece of music. And Ted Turner said, but he didn't know if I was Beethoven, if I was alive, dead, anything. And that's how I came to that project. And I, of course, turned it down because it was 18 hours of music. And it was originally a miniseries of this little TNT. He had started, and everybody at the time, this is before, said, you can't make original content at a cable station. You know, maybe this was about the time that The Sopranos came on, but it was like a joke. It's like, hey, the movie studios most of the time miss. So how are people? Well, then it became a big thing. But anyway, I talk about Ted in that case. Then the rest of the time I talk about Ivan. And yes, you're exactly correct. It's the relationship that you had and the music that you wrote. And when those things come together, I don't care if one person sees it. I really don't. It's that for me is the key. Just like right now, what I do in here is at the, you know, every day I do something. And if I like what I did, that's the satisfaction.
There's something very pure about that. You know, you're not influenced by commercialism or the critics or the popular reaction. You really care about the quality of what you did and the relationship you had with the director. There's something very pure about that that you don't see in this industry very often. And another thing that shocked me about you, I read that you deliberately did not watch Ghostbusters before deciding to write the soundtrack for Ghostbusters 2. Yes. Weren't you curious?
No, now hold it. I had seen Ghostbusters 5 years before that, like everybody else. I loved Elmer Bernstein, but when I was, no. And I must say, because it was a new, okay, you'll say, well, hold it. It's the same guys, thank God they were so great, and Sigourney Weaver and that other funny guy, I forgot his name. So it's basically, they're in New York, so what's different? Guess what? It's a different story. And what's my job? My job is to support the story. And that story was different than the first. I never watched it once. I knew the song. I knew Elmer's score had this odd Owens Martin. But I never never referred to it in the music. I never listened to it once. Not for a second. And I told them that. And nobody, even though when I said that later, a billion years later, by the way, after I got screwed and they released the soundtrack album to Ghostbusters 2, which is 95% Randy Edelman's score, I don't have one cut on the album. Why? Because during the 5 years after Ghostbusters and after the success of Ray Parker's record, you know, every R&B artist in the world, they were going to make the film. So everybody, you name them, go down the list. There were 100 records that were presented once they decided to shoot that movie. Big, huge artists. Some that weren't even big artists when they wrote it, like a Bobby Brown or something, but now were. So there was a political thing. Now, at the time, I had kind of just started, was happy to do the score, came out great. The picture was a huge hit. But on the soundtrack album, nothing, zero. Okay, but I moved on, no problem. Now it's, what was it last year, 2 years ago? The best soundtrack label there is, Sony Classics calls. We want to put out your score. You're kidding. I have been called a million times, but nobody wanted to really do it, pay the huge orchestra reuse fees. And anyway, so that was great. They lost the score. They lost, you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Sony lost not all of it, but a good part of it. So I had to figure that one out, which I did. And then they asked me to write these notes. And in the notes, I said, well, you just asked me, because you must have read it in there or heard about it from there. I never said that to anybody before. And it was like, that's a very arrogant thing to not only say, but you did that? Yeah, because it made sense. So, yes. And nobody could respect Elmer Bernstein more than me for The Man with the Golden Arm, for To Kill a Mockingbird, for a million things he had done. But I did not listen to that. So the answer is, yeah, never, not one thing of mine. You could listen to that soundtrack album, the new one. And so, yeah, 20 some odd years later, that soundtrack came out. Isn't that funny?
Well, I didn't find it arrogant at all. I thought it was actually your proof that you're open, that you wanted to not be kind of tainted by what already came, because this is a different story. And many of your movie scores end up getting reused for other things. Dragonheart, the Bruce Lee story, Gettysburg, they get used in commercials and award shows and the Olympics. That must be incredibly gratifying, Randy.
It is. Now, sometimes I will get calls when this started happening. Yeah, especially sports stuff, which I got into. That became a little great sideline of mine for Dick Ebersol, who was at NBC Sports, and then ESPN. So it was a nice thing. But people think, oh, you wrote. No, I never wrote anything. I wrote a movie score. I didn't write it with, ooh, that cue could be really good if they used it to open the Super Bowl. Where all that stuff happened. But no, they just liked something about it. And Ebersol, years ago, had called me when I was in New York doing a film called The Indian in the Cupboard with the great Frank Oz, director, a Big Bird originally. And I went over there and he said, look, I'm going to play you what we used in the World Series, the Breeders' Cup, the Wimbledon, all this stuff, all my stuff, different pieces. So, and he said, like, why don't you write something for us? Because at that time they were doing the NFL. That's the only time. And I did. And like literally 4 weeks later, the football season starts. And, you know, of course, my father and everything, that was, you know, that's success. He's watching this football game on Saturday. And I made sure, did it for almost nothing. Just put my name at the end of the football game, which they did. So now my father was like in heaven because he was watching.
And that's what you call giving your parents nachas.
You got all the terms. Yeah. But anyway, that became, and that was, I always thought it was great. The only time it wasn't great was the only other instance, and then we'll move on, was I did a little TV series when Fox started. It was called The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. I did the pilot because I couldn't get out of it. One of those, and the show maybe went on. I didn't do the shows. Maybe there were 6 shows, 8 shows, 10 shows. And then when this happened with the sports stuff, they called, they said, do you have anything that no one's ever heard? So I didn't have time. I told my engineer, put some stuff on a reel. And he put the theme of that show on, which he shouldn't have, because that was something that, well, lots of people heard, not that many, because Fox was still not happening. And the series was not particularly successful. Well, NBC goes wild with that piece of music. I was going to call them, but I decided, don't call them. The next thing I know, it's the theme of every show there is on NBC. So much so that when the next, whenever it was, Olympics started, I always had lots of things in the Olympics. They would call me the day before in New York from, what do you call that thing when they put music into these things, the night before an event happens. And I'd say, play this, play that, which is fantastic. But this is something else. They got to the Olympics and they decided to take the same thing from Briscoe County Jr. and use it as the ID music, like every time, coming up tomorrow. Well, this thing became like my most famous piece of music. It was called on the cue sheets, the Randy Edelman Olympic theme, let's say, published by Randy Edelman Music. You know what I mean? Well, in fact, it was Briscoe County Jr. theme published by Fox. Now, at the time, was I, what, am I going to pick up the phone? No, it's like done. It's years now. It goes on. One day, I think after he wasn't there anymore, Dick Ebersol comes home and one of his kids is listening on the television to this old series, Briscoe County Jr. Now, Ebersol hears the thing and says, holy shit, I didn't know that. And somebody called me. I said, yeah, what am I going to do? You know, like, so no, it's like I said, you got to hit people over the head. I could have called and said it originally, don't use it because, but for almost 20 years after getting awards for the Olympic theme, no one ever knew until he went home. And then I actually picked up the phone. I actually called whoever, you know, I think it was a Fox show, but Warner Music on it. And I said, you know what, this is that thing. And they, of course, didn't do it. They said, thank you very much. And now they have the rights. Except guess what? They stopped using it last year. Sorry. Right. I had 20 years. Anyway.
That's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. That's the moral of that story. You know, I know you're often referred to as the king of the comedies, but you've written soundtracks for every genre, right? Romance, action, thrillers, serious dramas, big epic films. Does it bother you that you're always called the king of the comedy?
No, not at all. Because, well, first of all, the reason it doesn't bother me is because I can put on Gettysburg or Last of the Mohicans or Dragonheart, and those things are not just, they're not just movies, but that music has been used. So I don't have to really deal with that at all, because I, and there's lots others I can just, they can just see and hear. So I don't mind. What happened with the comedies, it's one thing to do the big blockbuster comedies like Ivan's stuff. But what happened with me, the reason the comedy thing stuck, is then I would see a little picture. The Mask was a little picture at the beginning. It became the biggest picture going. But Jim Carrey had never had the Ace Ventura Pet Detective. It came out. It was a huge picture. My Cousin Vinny, another one I picked, a nothing. Both of those pictures, by the way, did not call me to do the scores. As a result of two or three people turning it down, they came to me, okay? And they were both, as I said, little pictures when they came to me. Now, My Cousin Vinny is a classic, but it was not a big hit movie. And when they made it, then I did Sandra Bullock's little picture, While You Were Sleeping. So what I'm saying is, yes, I did those bigger blockbuster comedies. But when I started picking these little pictures that didn't seem to be such high profile and they were hits, then it was like, oh, Randy must know something. I knew nothing. I saw something. I thought it was cute. And I worked. And then the final thing was Adam Sandler calling me, begging me. I did my first starring role. I heard the music. You got to do it. I said, listen, I think you're great, but I'm not. And especially, I knew what I can't do it anymore. I'm not doing any more comedies right now. Now he calls me. And I finally said, because when somebody's talented, like Jim Carrey, he's talented. Eddie Murphy was talented. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
He's not just some shtick. Some of these guys are really gifted. I knew Marissa Tomei before she won an Oscar for her little role in that comedy, but she was great in that part. So I said, so finally he calls me. This is all in a short period of time. I said, you know, about a year ago, I heard you sing a song on Saturday Night Live. He was not no longer on that show. It was called the Hanukkah song. And I thought, you know what? This guy's really talented. And I said, I'll tell you what. By the way, I didn't say I'd do his movie. I said, you could send the film over for me to see. If you do that song for me over the phone, this is before Zoom or cell phones, maybe beginning of cell phones. But 5 minutes later, he calls back and he does the whole thing for me. Because I remember when I heard it, it wasn't like some little thing 2 minutes long. It was a long, like oratory, an opera. It was like an aria. That's what impressed me. So he did it. He sent the film over. I had an angle, which was ridiculous right from the beginning. He said, again, he said, do whatever you want. Just do it. And I did it. And that was a little thing too. Then he really exploded with his movies, you know, eventually to become like a star. At the beginning, yes, he was another one of the guys from Saturday Night Live doing movies. Then he became, so that's another one. It makes it look like, holy shit, you know, Billy Madison, The Mask, My Cousin Vinny. I mean, these are like classic, but they were little movies. They weren't Ghostbusters 2 or Kindergarten Cop. And then, you know, so that's kind of what cemented that comedy thing a little more than just doing, you know, Ivan's film and the films with another guy, Rob Cohn, who wanted to be a director, but had done all kinds of other things. Really fascinating character who everybody said, don't do his films. And we did a couple of films like the Bruce Lee story, like Dragonheart, like Daylight about the Holland Tunnel collapsing with Sylvester Stallone. But they weren't big hits for him at all.
Do you find one particular genre of movie more difficult than another?
Oh, yeah, comedy, like hands down. That's the hardest. Adventure, romance, horror movies, action, they sort of dictate, Harvey, to me, what to do. Comedies are different. It's like, because if that person, like I said, is a really gifted comic, you don't play them musically at all. So you have to figure out what in this comedy are you playing? And usually it's some aspect of the story, the romance, the action, maybe something funny, but be careful at trying to put funny music with funny people who are really funny. You know what I mean? So
You make it sound so easy. You have to be fast and you have to be right. I wonder whether you really get how gifted you are that you can do what you do so prodigiously and so fast. Do you get how special that is?
I do. I understand it. But I don't at all consider it. I still am scared, which is when I start something, you've got an hour of music to write and you don't have anything and you've got somebody that thinks they know. So I still get nervous. But dealing just yesterday, just what's on my computer, this picture that I just did some wonderful films. One was a horror film. One was a country and Western film, all different. This one's like about a Christmas. And yesterday I do these a certain way. I no longer allow anybody over here. Okay. I don't allow
your writing. They can't come
ever. Okay. Now that's a whole other story. That's not years ago. That's not with the Ivans and the Ron Howards and the Michael Mann. So now I've evolved to a certain place that I only will work here with myself when I'm doing it. Don't bother me. And when they call me to do it, and I tell them at the beginning, and they go, well, whoa, whoa, I said, you know, that's great. Go call somebody else. There's a million people that'll do a good job. They won't do what I was going to do, but Okay.
But and they live with it.
And what that does is I tell them, even though it means they're all scared or they'll say, hang up, goodbye, you know, not too often with these kinds of things. In the end, though, what happens is I write twice as much music. Every scene may have two versions because no one's here bothering me. I accept once I am critical with what I do. Once I think whatever I did here is working well, I may stop, I may do that. Then I take to a little different take on the same scene. I could never do that if someone was knocking, bothering me and Jackie at my front door.
Yeah, I then love again, that you've become independent enough. You've reached a place in your life and in your career where you get to call the shots, you pick and choose what you do, and you decide how you do it, and they have to live with it.
Yes, but then I don't. Then I, at my own expense, will go, if it's down the street here, fine. If it's New York, fine. If it's Nashville, fine. If it's London, fine. If it's Belgium, fine. I will go there when it's done, done. You're not sitting by the piano saying, gee, I think done, mixed, and the A and B versions of each scene. And then they sit down and hear something granted that they've never heard before. I'm talking about yesterday, I played 90 minutes of music to a film that's 95 minutes long. That's unheard of. You know why? Because it needed it at every turn. It was more of like a Home Alone kind of thing, but with a little more. And the only other thing is, there ain't nobody playing. It's only me. There's not one musician on any of the stuff that I do anymore. Not in a certain situation. And I don't change the way I write. The same thing. When you listen to it, no matter what it is, country and western, orchestral, you wouldn't really know it. It sounds whatever it's supposed to be. It sounds, don't worry about it. I did it right where you see me sitting now. Then I take it and I make it sound great. But so yesterday, these guys, and I always hope the more you go for, if it works, the better it is, even though it's not maybe another film that only had a few cues that was easy and that you kind of knew what the music was going to be. That was easy for me. That's one thing. But this was a problem. Every single cue was a problem. Do I play that? What about these kind of mafia bad guys who are really a joke? You know what I mean? How am I going to play that? They're funny. But you got to take them seriously because they're threatening the dog. You know what I mean? But so now as they're listening yesterday, hearing this stuff, the director and the producer, and their mouths are like, and I play each scene, no sound, watch the movie, listen to the music. Then I go back and I push up the dialogue, which you know, always in this case, before they're mixed, can be dirty, but they know what it is. And then I go through the whole movie like that. And as each cue goes on, it's like, I never realized you've made them, blah, 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 blah. But you know what? They kept, so it was fantastic. And they couldn't have been more complimentary and terrific about it and appreciative. All that was going through my head was, you guys realize how much experience went into each note and sound of this. It's not just a gift or talented. It's a lot of stuff. And I've done a lot of stuff. And I'd like to think that that's why, you know, the guy would say, like, you made the acting didn't work. It works. You made the comedy funny. You made the drama. You made all, yeah, but yeah, I spend time on it, but I also have now, I can kind of look back, which is a good feeling, about years of doing it and spending the time with it, not dealing with you coming over my house every day like you wanted to do or flying into town for a week. I needed to do it my way And that's why it's good. But not because I did it my way, because I did it my way with what I have in my history that's allowing me to make proper decisions fast.
Can you teach what you do? Is this teachable?
It may be, but I would never do it, never get close to. Any attempt I've made when I've done, you know, Berkeley asked me to come and do master. No, you can say what you say, which is true about a lot of things, but you can't. You have to learn by doing it, by getting screwed, by having things in movies not work. And you learn, you know what? What you just did, you think it's funny. It's too much. And then you play it back and you leave something out. The technology, by the way, has helped all this, because you leave it out. Boom, press a button, it's out. And that's what I do with my engineer a lot when I go through the final process of this. But yeah, it's just, that's what was exactly what you said. That's what was going to, I didn't say that to them, but hey, it's not that I've done this before. I've been doing this, and many musical things come into the front of making decisions. It's not just movies. It may be something you recorded for something years ago, or a sound. And I say, hey, you know what? What was that sound? But it's not in my computer because I didn't, or because what the sampler wasn't invented. But I have an idea. So it all comes back, you know, conducting an orchestra at Abbey Road that I just did a couple months ago. That has to do with me conducting in Vegas for Bobby Gentry. You know what I mean?
You know, yeah, you've utilized every bit of your experience in orchestra pits on Broadway. And then you have, you know, these wonderful songs that come out of you. You are coming out the other side, which had a fun, optimistic message of hope.
That was a crazy one. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the song thing. Yeah. That must be something that I have and that I had, because film composers don't do that. And they don't. I mean, Randy Newman is fabulous. You know, it's kind of funny that our names are similar. But other than that, they can't do it, and they don't want to do it. And it's not, when I write a song, I don't try to write a song. I wrote Coming Out the Other Side during the pandemic as a fun thing. It wasn't written like, when this is all over, put on your tie. It was just a fun thing. I came out here, and then I did something in the middle of the night, and then the next day I said, actually, this may be worth, for the first time out of those 25 years, may be worth. That's how I met Eileen, you know, who's just a great, great lady, just the best.
Oh, yeah. Eileen Shapiro, we love you. And then you collaborated with Grandmaster Mel Mel. How did that come about?
Well, Eileen again is now, okay. What I didn't just like with Nelly, I didn't collaborate, I didn't sit in a room with them. They heard something of mine. Nelly was one thing. This is something else, because this is my record, and it's always my record. I would have been happy if he did anything. So he added something, but he added something, Harvey. It's incredible. If you read that, I think she wrote that story. He heard this thing. Too long. You know, I don't even know half of it. It was on like page 6 of the New York Post. That's evidently, you know, the thing in the world. It was there next to the picture of the Obamas yesterday, the day before, whenever it was, about this. There's a tie in here. But he heard this song through, I believe, Eileen getting it to someone else in Chicago. And I will make sure you get this album. It's from an album I did for ABBA 40 years ago. I didn't do it for ABBA. I did it for ABBA, for their record label up in their studio in Stockholm. And they messed it up. It was my record. It was just done for their thing. Won't get into it. You'll see the whole story when she'll send it to you next week. There's a song on there. So now all these years later, this thing's coming out. There's a song on there. Funkmaster Melly heard it and he heard what it was about. It was about being an outcast, being down and out, but not done in a preachy way. And there was a line, and it's called, the line was, when all good fortune seems to just go around you, in other words, it's missing you, when even angels seem to block your way. This guy hears that, flips out, thinks this is the best song he's heard, knows nothing that it wasn't written yesterday, that it was recorded, and gets an idea, and with a little push, comes up with his thing, Over My Track. It's not, and obviously he was into it because you can always tell. This is not some, ooh, I got an idea. No, this is something that this guy, who I will meet in a couple of weeks, will, like, really got in his gut, and he spent the time, and they did it. So that's it, and it's kind of unreal. I mean,
it's a great song. It's beautifully done. Okay, I only have one more question for you. Are you ready, Randy?
Yeah.
How in the world are you getting inducted into the New England Hall of Fame when you're not even from New England?
Because I wrote.
There it is.
Time in New England
took me away.
Right. And by the way, that story of that song, because it just didn't tiptoe down the hallway to Barry Manilow and Clive Davis, that's a whole other show that I'll do with you someday.
I would love that. Well, I've got to tell you, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you and talking about your amazing career. You are a walking encyclopedia, not only of music, but of the science and the art of film scoring. You are amazing. And I'm so grateful you took the time to appear on our show. Thank you so much, Randy.
No problem. Thanks, Harvey. I'll talk to you again, and good luck and stay safe.
You too.
Talk to you on the coming out the other side.
Our guest has been the iconic composer, musician, recording artist, and performer, Randy Edelman. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Deborah Batsafin, my production assistant, Rosa Puzo, my PR director, Laurie Towers, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin, grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou. you to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.